know all about this, Dick. This is about the Arecibo Observatory AO 430 megahertz radar. It involves such techniques as phase and quadrature phase channels that, and detecting groups of 45 microsecond pulses using a IPP return of interpulse period. That would be a return of 250 complex voltage samples. They use a bunch of variable windows in this thing. I know if you don't know about this, my description would never be enough for you, but I have a feeling that you're probably thoroughly familiar with it and know exactly what I'm talking about. It uses something called autocorrelation to make it work. It's to detect very, very micrometeors between 85 and 122.5 kilometers in altitude. And it's a very, very interesting paper. I got it from the IEEE, and I've been wanting to read it a long time, but it would be nice to be able to understand what they're talking about. I have a vague idea, but I'm not familiar with all that radar technology that much. So if you could enlighten me just so I can read it a little bit more intelligently, I'd much appreciate it. Go ahead, Dick.
A comment for him, Dick, about HIP.
Okay. Hey, Lou, this is the technical net. You're getting technical. Boy, you're getting technical. Go right ahead, Mel. Tell him which kit he should buy.
I had some a similar experience with so-called young prodigies and all. And I got them into something that is really a bit challenging for them, but they also got a tremendous amount of satisfaction. Lou, go to Radio Day, RADIOBAZE. They're vintage radio and electronic, but they have a whole bunch of low-price kits where you can build small radios and oscillators and all that. You wind the coils and a whole business. You breadboard it out. And if you want an electronic challenge that is, for, I guess, say, young people that really have a fairly decent understanding, they can grasp things, you'll find it Radio Day, some of these low-price, low-end kits, but we'll definitely give them a great challenge, Lou, over.
RadioDays.com, is that what it is, Mel?
R-A-D-I-O, let me see what their website is, so I have it here, Radio Days, R-A-D-I-O-D-A-Z, like Zulu Echo. And general, let's see, general faxes, some faxes, let me see. I'm looking, oh, here we are, website, www.radiodace.com, over.
No, thanks. I will look that up and go through there and see what they can come up with. I assume since it's old radio, it's not all tubes or anything. It's they have some solid-state stuff that he could build, because I don't think he's too young. He's there. I don't think he knows anything about tubes. Go ahead.
Anything you want. They have everything from crystal radios, one-tubers, and all kinds of little gadgets, I can say, that are the low price so that they won't dig into your wallet too much, and you'll most likely get thank you galore, a wonderful birthday present, or whatever, end of school year present, Lou, over.
Okay, Mel, I'll certainly give it a try, and I thank you very much. I'll let you know how I made out with it. Go ahead.
Take it.
Okay, now,
I.O.
Who was that again? You're going to call it something like I.O.?
KQ.I.O. with comment on the robot kit.
Go right ahead, Mr. Y.O.
I don't know the exact web address, but Google, hit them real quick. Look for Ramsey Kits, R-A-M-S-E-Y. They make a number of radio kits, but they also make some small robotic kits. Wouldn't be too too complex for a 12-year-old or in a quite reasonable price range, possibly, you know, depending on how much effort he's going to put into it this summer, he may build a couple of them. But check out the Ramsey folks. They make a number of stuff. K2YO clear.
Thank you very much. I will do that also. W2JPW.
Okay, now, I've had an unusual client over the last year where I've had to do some fairly basic research into an electronic phenomenon, and as such, what I purchased was a number of items from a company called Science First, sciencefirst.com. Simply go to that page, and the first page will give you a little bit of an introduction, where they sell individual items at rather nice prices, in my opinion, with reference to astronomy, force and motion, electricity, magnetism, density and heat, laboratory equipment, field, environment testing equipment, anatomical testing equipment, and so on. So I think it's a company in the Buffalo area, but sciencefirst.com sells some rather nice things. The very first page will show you a child holding on to a Van de Graaff generator in the hand, standing up on end. I believe the Van de Graaff generator I own, which is not the big one that's shown on the front cover, the smaller one, I was using for a series of experiments. So not directly related to electronics the way you think about it, Lou, but there are definitely some items there which will impress your grandchildren, your children, and so on. Quite possibly what I think you're going to eventually do is to get one or two of the items from Science First, as well as items from Radio Days and Ramsey and so on. So investigate all of them, Lou. Now, let me drop for a second. I'm going to come back and tell you what I know about the Arecibo radar. I'll give a little bit of a pause just in case someone wants to give us another suggestion, and or you need some fill there, Lou. K2RIW, you're listening for a second. Okay. When it comes to detecting a radio signal, every one of us know that we use an antenna, a low noise amplifier, a receiver front end, usually has an RF amplifier, a mixer down to a first IF, maybe another mixer down to a second IF, a final bandwidth determining filter into a detector. The detector quite often is a diode. The diode tells you the envelope of the amplitude of the signal that's being modulated. In a case of a AM radio, the simple diode detector, the amplitude detector, tells you everything you want to know. Your car radio, when it's listening to half meg to 1.5 megacycles, you might listen to a Wind 1010 New York, so to speak. That is an AM envelope detector. Well, to the smart people who understand how electronics really work, detecting the envelope is only giving you half of the information. You're lacking the phase information. Half of all the information that a radio wave consists of is its amplitude and its phase. Therefore, the next level of sophistication would be a product detector. That's what's used in a single sideband receiver. It injects a very strong local oscillator and detects the signal in a particular way. It is really taking the sine wave of the incoming signal, multiplying it with another sine wave, and the multiplication of the two, the product of the two, is what comes out of that thing. When the two are positive, out comes a positive voltage. When either one is positive or negative, out comes a negative voltage. When both of them are negative, out comes a positive voltage. Two negatives multiply to a positive. So that's a product detector. The next level of sophistication above that is called an IQ demodulator, in-phase and quadrature demodulator. There's one way of looking at it. It's also called a vector demodulator. I work with these a whole lot when it comes to RFID receivers. Almost every modern-day radio frequency identification tag type receiver is a vector demodulator. Now, here's what we mean by that. You find out how much amplitude. Now, let me go back a step. Make believe I'm putting my signal, half of my signal, I'm splitting it. I'm putting it into the X, the horizontal plate of an oscilloscope. Half of my signal, my RF sine wave signal, I'm putting into the vertical plate. If I put equal amplitude in phase to the horizontal plate and to the vertical plate, at the instant of time, the horizontal is going positive, the vertical is going positive. When both go negative, the net result is I will get a 45 degree
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I will get a slanted line across the screen of the oscilloscope at a 45 degree angle slanted to the right. I'm putting the exact same amplitude of a sine wave into the horizontal plate and into the vertical plate. So at the instant the sine wave is plus 1 volt, and I put plus 1 horizontal and plus 1 vertical, I'm moving the dot one square over to the right and one square up, and vice versa, one square down, one square to the left. You can see how I generate a 45 degree line. If I'm now smart enough to delay the horizontal signal versus the vertical signal by a quarter of a wavelength, 45 degrees, correction, 90 degrees delay, by either electronic means with an LC network or an extra length of cable or whatever, if I connect a delay line a quarter of a wavelength long between the source of the signal and the horizontal plate, I will now have the exact same signal going into both, but 90 degrees phase shifted. I will make a perfect circle on the oscilloscope. It takes a little bit of practice with a or an XY piece of graph paper, or maybe even with polar graph paper, but you can confirm this. So equal amplitude and exactly 90 degrees of phase shift between the two signals makes a perfect circle on the oscilloscope. As you start changing the phase shift or the amplitudes, you now can make a wide ellipse, a narrow ellipse. You can make all kinds of things on the oscilloscope screen. And if there was a slight shift in the frequency between the signal you're putting on the horizontal and the signal you're putting on the vertical, you'll see this dancing pattern on the screen that they call a Lissajou pattern. I think Mr. Lissajou is the first guy who actually invented this. If I'm trying to zero beat two oscillators on the exact same frequency, when they were 10 hertz apart and I put them both into a receiver, I'll hear the beat note between the two. I'll hear a wobbling sound at a 10 hertz rate. But when it goes down to 1 hertz of difference between the two, and I'm putting both of them into a receiver to try to get zero beat, very few receivers will allow you to hear a 1 hertz difference between two signals. Put the two of them into an oscilloscope, and you watch this fancy pattern go between a ellipse that tilts to the left, the ellipse that tilts to the right, it goes circle, it goes into a horizontal straight line to the a 45 degree line to the right, a 45 degree line to the left. These are all the individual phase shifts between two signals being displayed on an oscilloscope. That's a Lissajou pattern. You're getting a little bit of a feeling for now that there is something independently happening on the horizontal plates of the oscilloscope and the vertical plates. And by properly putting signals between the two and understanding the display,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
By properly understanding that display, a lot of additional information can come out. So if you're trying to really zero beat two signals very, very exactly, and if you can make that Lissajou pattern on the screen stop crawling entirely, absolutely sit still in any one of its manifestations, you truly now have zero beat between those two oscillators. I could call the signal that's deflecting the oscilloscope plates horizontally, I could call it the in-phase signal. The signal that's displaying that's displacing the dot on the screen vertically, I could call this the quadrature signal. Quadrature meaning that it's 90 degrees phase shifted. Well, it's shifted in space 90 degrees. One is pushing the dot up and down, one is pushing it left and right. Electronically, you can do that without an oscilloscope. You can have an in-phase and a quadrature demodulator. If you like, you could call it a product detector for the in-phase signal and a product detector for the quadrature signal. They call it I and Q, in-phase and quadrature. When you have a true, and the result of those two separate video outputs, the I output and the Q output, when you boil it down to video, because you've done this vector demodulator is one way to call it, product detector for the in-phase, product detector for the quadrature phase. We call those the INQ vector signals. Once you've got that INQ vector signal, you have extracted every single piece of information that's contained in that radio wave. You know the exact phase. You know the exact amplitude. You know whether or not the signal is moving slightly up in frequency compared to your reference or slightly down in frequency. In other words, I'm not only measuring with the INQ signal, am I 1 hertz wrong, but I'm finding out, am I 1 hertz high or 1 hertz low by the way the lizardry pattern moves clockwise or counterclockwise, so to speak. So all possible information of amplitude and phase of the signal is there with an IQ demodulator. Now you take that I and Q signal, digitize the I and digitize the Q, and put it into the right kind of a computer. Wow! You can extract information from that signal like you wouldn't believe. And it wouldn't matter if the signal is pulse, single sideband, AM, FM, phase modulation. No matter how you modulate the signal, in angular modulation, amplitude modulation, mix it with noise, pulse it with any kind of a wave shape, put inter-pulse modulation signals, whatever. It is the most universal detector possible, that INQ vector demodulator. They call it vector
repeater, timeout, cancel.
They call it vector because it measures, what does the vector do? A vector of force tells you the direction and the strength. You need both pieces of information to really find out whether or not your rocket motor is blasting in the right direction to move your rocket ship in the right direction. It's a vector you have to have in the most general sense. An IQ modulator is a vector demodulator. Once you have it, and you now process radar signals or any kind of a signal, you can now take the individual pulses of a radar return. You can recognize the fact that each one is slowly advancing in phase because the object you're reflecting your radar signal across is moving away from you, or they're slowly retarding in phase. I got it backwards. Advancing in phase because the target is moving towards you, or the signal you're getting back as an echo is moving lower in phase because it's moving away from you. You can determine velocity of the target, angle of the target, all kinds of good information. Now if I transmit a whole lot of individual pulses and lay the pulses on top of each other, which is a kind of an integration process, and if I do it properly with correcting the phase and the amplitude, I now can recognize the fact that there's a certain signal-to-noise ratio. The signals themselves that are the reflection off of the target are coherent. There's a relationship between each one of them. And if I do it correctly, the voltages will add. The noise that's in the background is incoherent. Each pulse of noise is not identical to the next pulse of noise. So when I add a whole lot of pulses on top of each other, let me drop. All of the voltages add directly. All of the noise adds as the square root of voltages, because sometimes they're in phase and sometimes they're out of phase. So as I add more and more pulses on top of each other in my integration circuitry, I now can get a continuous improvement in the signal-to-noise ratio. That's the integration process. A good airborne Doppler radar does that. You and I, using my single sideband receiver with a good set of earphones, can probably listen to a weak signal in the tone in the noise, and maybe listen to a signal of around minus 130 dBm. Minus 107 dBm is a microvolt, minus 137 dBm, darn weak signal. By this integration process of pulsed signals that are not even continuous, they're not even there continuously, but they're only 0.1% of the time, which really puts you at a huge disadvantage. That's the way a radar works. But you use a range Doppler matrix, a fancy kind of circuit that uses one of these IQ demodulators on an airborne radar. You can pick targets out of the noise, 135 dB minus dBm at the antenna, and get a beautiful signal-to-noise ratio picture on the screen, and the dot on the screen of a range Doppler matrix tells you, is that target moving away or moving toward you? How strong is it? Where is it located? Tremendous amounts of information with proper processing comes out of it. I flashed a bunch of words at you. I tried to give you a couple of concepts. I know this is not going to be easy to swallow the first time. But if you start Googling the word vector demodulator, IQ demodulator, in-phase and quadrature demodulator, you start Googling any of those words, I guarantee Wikipedia's got a couple of articles on it, and you start reading it, it's going to be a mind-blower for you, Lou. You're going to start suddenly finding out, wow, there's a lot more to radio, and particularly radar, which is the more sophisticated kind of radio, a lot more to it than first meets the eye. You've had a bit of an introduction, a sort of a rough one, but you got to start somewhere. W2JPW, hopefully with a couple of more questions. K2RIW, the TechNet.
The comment dictates to KEY.
Okay, let's first find out if Lou's got any questions on what he's heard so far, and I'm going to turn it right over to Mel. Lou first. Go ahead, Lou.
Well, it is a little difficulty, but not much. I mean, I've realized the complexity is far greater than the few notes I've taken from what you said. In other words, I understood what you said, but I realized the real complexity of studying something like this. I just wanted to get an idea of really how it works. And, yeah, I will Google those things up and try to find out more about it. I have one question. I didn't write down the, you said 135 dB. I didn't write down the number of decibels below the receiver noise that this system would function at. I probably could have added the two or subtracted them or something and figured it out, but I didn't write those numbers down. So if you give me that idea, Dick, go ahead.
Okay. Got me into another whole area. WSJT, the Joe Taylor techniques, weak signal Joe Taylor, K1JT, the people who are using his modulation and demodulation techniques are listening to signals as weak as 28 decibels below the noise and getting 95% copy on the oscilloscope, on the computer screen. It's a message written out with its prediction of accuracy and whatever, 28 dB below the noise because of the IQ vector demodulator integration technique. In his case, he's sending out a series of four tones, but the four tones are very well known as to their exact frequency, and therefore each individual symbol you want to transmit, whether it's a either number one or the letter A, each symbol that you want to transmit is a sequence of some combination of those four tones being present or not present. And so it's a kind of a radio teletype where it's not just mark and space. It's a kind of radio teletype in which you make a determination on whether or not each one of those four tones is there or not in the noise. And again, it's a vector demodulator that's doing it, and you're laying a bunch of information on top of each other to integrate the noise out and get the signal out of the noise. So it sounds complicated at first, Lou. Don't be intimidated by it. You've heard the word computer for the last 25 years of your life. You're not afraid of it anymore. You probably have a pocket calculator. You've got a desktop, a personal computer, and so on. Obviously, if you were Rip Van Winkle and you slept for the last 40 years and you suddenly woke up and you saw what kids and parents are doing with computers today, it would overwhelm you. It doesn't. You've lived through the evolution of these computers in our home, and it's not that bad. When it comes to the more sophisticated, the more sophisticated ways of sucking a signal out of the noise. Once you learn a few of these concepts, it won't intimidate you anymore. It won't seem that complicated. Step by step, you'll eventually learn it if you care. And you can teach it to your children and so on. It is the way of the future. The 16-qualm technique by which a telephone modem, a simple, plain old telephone system, which only has 4.5 kilohertz of bandwidth. By normal techniques, you could only send 4,500 bits of information per second. A good telephone modem is capable of sending 56,000 bits per second, 56 kilobits, even though there's only 4.5 kc of bandwidth. Some of these techniques are involved. Now, Mel's going to clear it up for us. I'm having some fun with you, Mel. K2KEY, go right ahead with your message. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Definitely. I was there at that repo, and the road in the carriage house, 400 and, oh my God, about close to 450 feet above the antenna. And I can basically tell you how the whole thing worked, because my friend Bob Zimmerman at that time was sort of in charge of the operation back then. And very interesting system that they had there. First of all, they had this parametric amplifier, this parametric gas-fed amplifier that was built by, I think, Dick, did you build that amplifier? Because I know it came from Long Island over.
Okay, a guy named, why can't I think of his name right now? It'll come to me in a few minutes. The Applied Electronics Division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory had a man, who I can't think of his name right now, who really pushed forward parametric amplifiers back in the days when transistors didn't go that far. And the Central Research Department of AIL was building the gallium arsenide varector diodes that went into the parametric amplifiers. They're still being used on the space shuttle, by the way, the AIL-made parametric amplifier. The Ohio Radio Telescope out in Miamisburg, Ohio, by Dr. John Krause, used a parametric amplifier made by AIL. Every single company in the United States, a few years ago, this research was done, where parametric amplifiers are being manufactured, either the chief engineer, the president of the company, or some other key individual of that company once worked for the Applied Electronics Division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and they all worked for this particular man who I can't think of his name of right now. Back to you, Mel.
I think his name was Paul something, am I correct?
No, that's close, but it's not it. I'll think of it. Please proceed.
Why the name Paul jumped up to my head. Okay, anyhow, basically what they were doing there, once they had this amplifier, they then had what they was known as, I believe they called it the 18-centimeter receiver with dual channel 18-centimeter, yeah, with a right and, the left and right circular polarization. Basically, that was the so-called front end of the system. After it went through the processing, a number of processes of IF, I believe the after the 1420 megahertz parametric amplifier, they boiled it down to like a 260 IF. Then another mixer brought down to like 30 megs, and then eventually through a bandpass filter, if I remember correctly, that was around 5-something, I don't remember what the bandpass was. But after it exited the low-pass filter, which was only around 500 hertz, the signal was split then, followed along. In other words, this is the procedure. Signal then split into what is known as a sine and a cosine, and then goes into a multiplexer, which was a 12-bit HD multiplexer, and then was transferred to the computer and was analyzed by what they is known as FFT, Fast Fourier Transform. Dick, this is basically what I remember of the system, Dick, over.
Okay, you've joggled my memory, and I'm remembering now more of the stuff. The in-phase and quadrature, sometimes called sine and cosine, it's sometimes called I and Q, but once again, a signal simply rectified with a diode and plugged into an audio amplifier into a loudspeaker gives you amplitude modulation, demodulation, envelope detection only, and you're throwing away the phase of the signal that's inside the envelope. But you use a real sine and cosine demodulator. It's got three or four different names, as you can tell. Now you're getting all the possible information there. By the way, the man's name is Matthew Leibenbaum. Matt Leibenbaum, Dr. Leibenbaum, was the guy who really made parametric amplifiers a easily purchased commercial product. It was a pretty hairy product when Sam Harris, with his own hands up at Microwave Associates, built the very first one that was ever designed. I mean, this is the great paper idea, a parametric amplifier, way back in the late 50s, early 60s. On paper, people said, gee, we can build an amplifier using nothing but the negative impedance characteristic of a variable capacitance diode that's being pumped at a very high frequency, and we can build an amplifier out of that, even though we don't have transistors that can go that high, we don't have tubes that can go that high, but we can force a diode to do this, as long as you've got the right kind of circulators, because a diode negative impedance amplifier, you've got the exact same signal going in and coming out from the exact same port, and without circulators to keep track of who's going in and who's going out, you build a great big oscillator as opposed to an amplifier, so to speak. Okay, so Matt Leibenbaum was the Johnny Appleseed of parametric amplifiers, just about every company in the world at one time. A key person used to work for Matt, work with or for him. He ran a great school, as you can tell already. Sine and cosine, we figured that one out. We figured out the man's name. The first time you hear all this jazz, you're going to be a little bit intimidated, Lou. But once you start digging into it step by step, it ain't that bad. It's just that you're hearing it for the first time. It's not well taught in all of the schools until you really take a course in communication. And now that you want to understand, let me drop all of the very complicated techniques that work with your cell phone, with your wireless LAN network, with your global positioning satellite receiver system, every one of those sophisticated modern-day receivers are using some form of vector demodulator. Once you've got the I and Q signal, the in-phase and quadrature detected video, and now you digitize it, and you do a fast Fourier transform on it, you do a pulse integration, you do there's all kinds of techniques you can apply to the signal to suck the signal out of the noise. Once you know some a priori knowledge about the nature of the signal, you can create a model. In fact, the way a global positioning satellite receiver works is it starts off with a signal that is 24 dB below the noise of your receiver. A GPS receiver that you hold in your hand, every one of them is doing that. You've got a 1 decibel noise figure front end at 1,572 megacycles. You can't get any lower noise figure than that in something you can hold in your hand. You got a tiny little antenna there. You could build a bigger antenna on it, but it doesn't need it because it's got all kinds of fancy processor gains. But it starts off with a signal coming from that satellite. It's a 10-watt signal, 10,000 miles away. By the time it gets into the antenna that's in your GPS receiver, in your hand, or in your automobile, that's a signal 24 dB below the noise. The system takes that into a sine and a cosine, as Mel was saying, digitizes it, applies a very fancy network to it in which it recognizes the fact that the signal from satellite number 14 has a very specific pseudo-random code. Your receiver reconstructs that known code, and it slowly slides the code it's constructed with the code it's receiving from space, slides one versus the other in the time domain, advances one or retards it until they line up. When they line up, the integrator starts making the signal jump out of the noise by something like 34 dB. You get that much processor gain out of the pseudo-random integrated process. And therefore, a signal that starts off 24 dB below the noise with 34 dB of processor gain ends up 10 dB above the noise, and you demodulate that signal from satellite 14, it basically says, hello, Lou, I'm satellite 14. Right now, this is what the time is. This is where I am located. And this is where the other 23 satellites of the series are located. Go get them. It gives you that information. Super weak signal, but it does more than just envelope detection. As I said, you're going to have to hear this a few times, Lou, before it makes sense. Don't be intimidated by it. It'll sound darn...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It'll sound darn complicated at first. But after you hear it a few times, read it a few times, read some Google search words, read some Wikipedia on it, pick up a couple of books on it, all of a sudden you'll say, boy, I wish somebody had told me that sooner. I could have designed some really fancy ham radio receivers. And stop saying, I could have, and start saying, I will design some very fancy equipment myself. I can buy integrated circuits for 50 cents a piece out of a catalog. I put them together in the right combination, and I can do this jazz myself. The integrated circuit chip that does that vector demodulator, you would think back in the days with tubes, it would fill up a whole bench. Nowadays, it's a little black chip that's got 14 leads coming out of it, and it'll cost you 50 cents. You just use it as a building block with a few other things like it, and you make all this stuff happen. Hope I'm not scaring you with all this jazz, Lou. And we're going to move on right after I send it back to you one more time. W2JPW, darn good question. KQRIW TechNet. Obviously, there's a lot more to the story than you've heard so far.
I want to make one more comment, Dick, when you get a chance.
Filling me in on it. It's, it doesn't really frighten me or anything. I can read up on it. I'm pretty good at reading scientific material and understanding it when I know the definitions of what's being discussed. And now I have a better idea of what it is. So I will Google all these things up, and I thank you all for all the information. I just wanted to read about this. This is something that's fascinated me for a long time. The only thing I wanted to know that we don't have time for now is, does this Arecibo radar, when it does, it does things like scattering from electrons in the upper ionosphere, for instance. They do experiments with that. I forgot the name. It's Rayleigh scattering or something. I forgot which one it is. There's a couple of different kinds. They also experiment with the micrometeorites, or not meteorites, meteors. Meteorites are big. At 120 kilometers or so above the Earth's surface. Do they point the dish always upward at 90 degrees to do this, or do they have a way of angling the beam sideways or down below the zenith? I'm just curious about that, then I'll stop monopolizing your time. W2JPW.
One more comment, Dick.
I'm going to be passing it over to Lou. And the Arecibo dish is a spherical dish, not parabolic. Therefore, you can move the feed horn and steer the beam. And I think they can steer it plus or minus 15 degrees from straight up, from zenith. So when you want to look at the moon with that, you have to wait till the moon's in the right spot, if you know what I mean. You can only look at it for about an hour or so at a time, 2 hours at a time, plus or minus 15 degrees. Moon moves 14 and a half degrees per hour, apparent, because of 15 degrees per hour of rotation of the Earth and half a degree per hour of actual motion of the moon. Hence, it comes out 14 and a half. Mel, tell him more about that beautiful trip you took down to Arecibo. How long ago was it? And if I wanted to take that trip today, how many thousand dollars would I have to put in somebody's hand to make sure I get the same tour you got? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I didn't pay anything for it to have a connection. It was 1985, Dick. Yes, one other interesting factor that they had there that I really was really, you know, very impressed. Because of the size of the dish and the way it's moving, like you say, what they do with the signals that go into the computer, there is a problem that they found that existed. And first thing they do is they synchronize everything with this rubidium clock. The next thing they did, which was very, very intelligent, I forgot who came up with this idea, somebody from professor from Harvard, I remember, was telling me, came up with this idea what they call a frequency sweeping of the oscillators to compensate at that time for Doppler shift caused by the Earth's rotation. And this was known as Earth. Now, I'm trying to remember how they pronounced that word. It was Earth Empress, Dick. Do you recall what I'm saying? Over.
Sure do. It's called Earth Ephemeris Time Shifting Technique. And by the way, that kind of an oscillator is rubidium. Cesium is the cesium beam clock is a very expensive. It's the most accurate clock I know of. And the next one down is rubidium. Rubidium is a particular element. I think it's a an element like helium. In other words, it's a molecule that's got all of its outer rings completely filled up. It is a so-called noble element. It doesn't want to combine with anything else. But rubidium gas of the right pressure inside of a vessel has a very specific frequency at which it gives you a certain kind of oscillation, and it gives you an extremely accurate clock. Maybe it's 100 times more accurate than the best crystal oscillator you can get a hold of. So ephemeris really means that you figured out the timing of some sequence of events. Ephemeris time. Whenever you get your data down with reference to tracking a particular satellite, like an Oscar satellite, and they give you all of those numbers like ellipticity of orbit, altitude of orbit, period, right ascension of ascending node, argument of perigee, all of these numbers are telling you, I think it's a series of seven numbers, six or seven numbers, that uniquely define what the satellite does, where is its apogee, where is its perigee, how fast is it precessing, and what was the epoch time at which you made the measurement. Where was it all referenced to, so to speak, so that now you can make a prediction in the future where it's going to be. So in the case of the moon's orbit, let me drop. The moon's orbit around the Earth, perturbed by sun and a whole bunch of other forces, the precession and the so-called Saros cycle of the moon, all of this is predictable. Therefore, you can crank in all of the Doppler shifts created by all of the crazy motions of the moon, and therefore increase the accuracy of the demodulation of the signal you're getting back from it if you're trying to do exact mapping of the moon. And so by radar signal technique, you can get a photograph of the moon or Venus, and they've done that. Venus has got this very thick cloud cover. By using very fancy processing techniques with the Arecibo dish, they have made a radial map of what the surface of Venus looks like under those clouds. And they're doing that from numbers like 50 million miles away. Very good trick. Lots of good information there to dig into to keep you reading and keep you occupied on a cold winter night, Lou. I better move on. Fred was the next person who signed in, KC2OES. I hope he doesn't stump the people present here tonight. You've got it, Fred, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, all. This is Fred, KC2OES. My question is a little more down to earth, I think. But I may not be able to get an answer, but I'll try. I have an FT920, a Yaesu. I have a Turner plus three microphone. I have diagrams for both the microphone, the jack, and the connector. Problem is, there's no common wording for colors or the connection for me to make a decision as to how I'm going to do this. The microphone for the Turner is shield, red, black, and I'll call it clear or white. I have the Yaesu connector on the face of the radio, which is 8-pin, and I'll just let you take it from there and see if someone can help guide me through this.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but some of the more modern, sophisticated microphones have got a shielded piece of coaxial cable that actually constructs the audio, connects the audio from the microphone to the rest of the radio. It also has a push-to-talk button. It probably has a bunch of other touch-tone tone buttons. It's got an up-down frequency shift button, and so on. And those all have to be wired just right. I presume you're putting a connector on the end of the cable because you're taking a microphone that either didn't have a connector on the end, or you're moving it from connector type A to connector type B to make that beautiful microphone compatible with your particular FT920. That's what I think you're doing. Mel, how do your guys in the Kings County Radio Club solve this particular problem when they run into it? I'm going to toss it over to you, sir. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
been there, done it many times. This is K2KEY, simple. Find, first of all, with not pushing anything, not to push the talk or anything, just take a meter and put it on the case of the mic, the metal casing of the mic, and determine which wire is the ground wire. Usually the black wire will show up as your common ground. The next thing you'll do is you're going to push the talk and see which one has the switch action. Usually it's the red, black, and green wire system. It would usually be the green wire. Usually the red wire is reserved for the element, for the mic element, if it's a three-wire system. Now, to be sure that the mic element is the, or which one is the mic element, like by now I'm sure you'll have determined just with a meter test which of the two, the ground and the switch for the push to talk. But if you want to confirm that the element, which is the element, definitely which is the element, you'll just whistle into the mic, connect the oscilloscope, any oscilloscope, right across it, turn up the gain of the oscilloscope, and whistle into it, and you will see which is the mic element. Now, once you know those three, then it's just a matter of wiring it in. I will assume that the Turner mic that you're using is a three-wire system. Am I correct? Over.
I would, there's actually four wires now, but they call it a three-wire, I believe. I'm looking at all the diagrams in front of me. I guess in order to get a scope on this, you'd have to have it in front of you or write it down as a phone. But the Turner mic says three-wire. Shield is ground, which is a braided wire, wrapped around the white wire. Now, by connecting the braided shield to the meter and to the base of the microphone, the metal part of the microphone, that's ground. When I put it across the white wire or the shield and press the push-to-talk switch, it breaks the circuit. They're calling that white wire mic or audio. The black wire, they're calling transmit. The red wire, they're calling receipt.
72RIA.
Yeah, usually the reason that they short is when you let go to push the talk, they short out an element many times just to protect the element from anything coming back up into it that may damage it. But you can determine, like I say, basically you've determined now which is the two elements, the element and the, I think you were able to determine now which is the push to talk, because that's about all you really need, over.
We're calling that the white wire, that where the shield or braided wire is wrapped around then. When I press the push to talk, it disconnects, or, you know, this, I have a multimeter with an audible signal on it, and for continuity, basically, it disconnects.
Usually that's what it is. You're not seeing a disconnect, you're seeing an ungrounded, you're ungrounding the element, that's basically. All right, somebody else said they want to make a comment, maybe they're more familiar with that particular microphone than I am, but I'm giving you generally how these mics are wired. I believe it was an RIA. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it was W2RAA. Start off with your name, sir, and then your information on this subject. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. This is Paul, W2RIA. I had a microphone like that probably 30 years ago, and I think I remember that they gave you two sets of push-to-talk wires on it. One was normally closed, one was normally open. The white wire, I believe, was just the audio wire, and you are correct that the, I think it was grounded during receive just to prevent pickup in the audio amplifier. So the white is the audio, the shield is the ground, and then you have two sets of wires for switching. One normally open, one normally closed, and that's my recollection from 30 years ago. It's a long time, but that's pretty much what I remember. The extra pins on the FT920, which I happen to own also, support the remote switching functions from the microphone. You know, there are up-down switches on it, so you can pretty much ignore them. You just need to get the basics if you want to have a microphone connected to it, W2RIA.
I thank you, Paul. That sounds like pretty good information. Sounds like a little bit of experimenting is going to be required, Fred, but as you wire it incorrectly, most of the time no damage occurs. So I think you're not going to get smoke and flames here. And even if you don't get it exactly right the first time, I think you're going to eventually get it. Hang in there. KC2OES, K2LAW on the TechNet.
Small comment there, KC2.
Okay, go right ahead, Mel.
Hey, the only ones you got to be careful is the ones that go to the element. That's the shield with that white wire. That's most likely definitely to the element. If you want to confirm that, if you have the availability of scope, just put the scope across that, push the talk, and talk into the mic just to confirm that's the element. Make sure that that does not get across the switching of the push to talk, because the switching of the push to talk, that goes to a relay. That is the coil of the relay, and usually it has a voltage on it that can damage the element of the microphone. So you just want to make sure you never get the element of the microphone across those two contacts. And what you're seeing is the switching. Yes, some of them had positive or negative. Some of the relay circuits, I should say, were unenergized. When you push the talk, they require an unenergizing for some reason. I mean, Collins does that. In other words, the coil is is energized and received, but unenergized in transmit. Just that way they worked it out. So that way they give you an ease of feature in the mic that you need to use. Normally open switch or normally closed switch. But that's the only thing you got to do, is just be careful of the element, not to get across those voltages. Other than that, I think that you won't really do any damage other than that. Go ahead, Dick.
And some of the more modern radios, the current that flows through the push-to-talk function is a very low current, because it's no longer directly powering a relay. It's powering a Schmidt trigger circuit, an electronic circuit. So some of them are only issuing numbers like a milliampere or so. So even that danger, obey the rules that Mel just gave you, just to be double-gone sure. But with modern-day radios having so little current flowing through that circuit, for a whole lot of reasons, they don't want a great big spike of voltage of the inductor kickback of a relay getting into the microphone circuit, so it would make a great big banging click sound every time you went from transmit to receive and receive to transmit. So I think even that danger is probably not to worry about. Back to you, Fred, for any further fill you might need. KC2OES, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay. I've eliminated three pins out of the eight on the radio face. Mic up, mic down, and fast scan. Now, there's five pins left. I only need four of those five pins. One of the pins says Earth plus 5 volts. The other pin is pin 5, which says Earth. The only three left now are PTT, which I believe I need, screen Earth, which I believe I need, which we're going to call the shield, I believe, and pin 8, which says mic. Does that make sense, Mel? And also, one more thing, the bottom of the microphone, it says relay or electronic.
Yeah, that's what the mic was good for, but the modern day radio, I don't think, connects the relay to the front panel anymore. Over to you, Mel.
He's still got a relay in that radio, Dick. That's his, that one he's talking about. Okay, so the earth or the ground, you can check very easy. Take your meter, and you'll see the ring, you know, the outer ring that locks the microphone connector on. Take your meter from that and find out which one is common to that. That is the casing ground. That's the one you want. The pin that says, of course, mic, you know about. But those are the two that after that you can, you know, experiment, put the push to talk one of them on to any one of those other pins with the PTT and see whichever way is either going to, you know, either going to lock the transmitter before you push the button to transmit, or nothing's going to happen. So you'll see whichever way it works. In other words, you're boiling it down to three pins with this mic, basically, over.
Okay, yeah, okay. What does, explain to me why one pin says Earth plus 5 volts, if you will.
It means to you what they did. A number of these radios, different things, they have what they call, there's a ground and there's a hot ground. I don't know how to explain it, but this is the system that was for some years that crept into electronics called above ground ground. Dick, maybe you can explain it better than I can. Over.
Yeah, some of the really smart radios have what they call B plus ground and signal ground. Some radios will have three different grounds. Somewhere way back at the fuse panel, so to speak, if there was such a thing, they all come together. But throughout the critical portion of the electronics, particularly on a multi-wire, a multi-layer printed circuit board, they'll have a layer which is B plus ground, another layer that's signal ground, it might be audio ground, and it might be another layer that's RF ground. And you try to keep them separate for a bunch of reasons to make sure that none of the RF signals get mixed into and the integrated circuits and create problems there. Yes, the relay is in the rig, but the relay might not be wired directly to the mic connector on the front panel. It may be wired by way of an integrated circuit chip that fires the relay itself. I think very few modern-day rigs bring the coil of the relay out the microphone connector. That's my belief, because the coil of a real relay, an electromechanical relay, has real inductance. It's got stored magnetic energy. And when you open up a switch, you get an inductive kickback from it. And that's really not compatible with the microphone wiring and the delicate, very low signals that are on a microphone. So I'd like to believe modern-day radios don't wire the relay coil that actuates it directly to the front panel microphone connector circuit. It's going through integrated circuits, I believe. Okay, I think we should go on to the next person. And Lou, if you're still listening, as you do your further research on the subject we discuss from week to week, please come back and tell us what you find. Fred, please let us know how your microphone works out there when you follow through with these suggestions. Tim was the next person who signed in, KC2 Lima, India Mike, I think it is. Tim, what would you like to talk about tonight? KC2RIW and the crew, my name is Dick. Okay, maybe Tim got called away. And Joe, we'll discuss anything except getting things on the right frequency. That was a joke. WA2RYY, we'd like to talk about anything you'd like to talk about, Joe. You got it.
All right, Jason, channel selectivity measurements.
It's called the Jason channel power ratio. And if you write yourself a really elaborate, accurate program to do ACPR, you'd be amazed what kind of fancy integrating electronics you get into. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, good evening, Dick, Mel, the B2YY here. My question is on interference I'm getting from a radio charger I'm using in the house on my repeater. It will interfere with the repeater if the receiver and the repeater set to carrier squawks, which is only tone operated. Other information you have on it with mic on this particular device. Only one of a couple of charges has to do it. When the repeater transmitter triggers, this device will take the repeater output energy and re-radiate it 5 megs below the input and cause interference to the repeater. Very weak, it's a repeater, but still it's there. The device itself is using a microprocessor inside, and that microprocessor uses a 4 megahertz clock. And I've done some tests where I've used something other than a repeater transmitter, and I could see the output of this thing on a spectrum analyzer. If I transmit into it and look a couple of megs away, I could see interference being reproduced at 1 meg intervals from 400 to 500 megahertz. Any comments on something like this and how you'd solve something like that?
Yep, let it drop. I've got some guesses here, Joe. You might have a 4 megacycle clock oscillator. Possibly it's being counted down to 2 megs, 1 meg, and maybe even lower. So it's got countdown circuits. Modern-day, very efficient integrated circuits, divide by two circuits. Some of them have extremely steep rise time and fall time. As such, if you studied the Fourier series of some kind of a square wave generator, which has very steep rise times and fall times, it is creating a spectrum that goes far and wide. You and I could, if we wanted to, take a 1 megacycle crystal oscillator, put it into a Schmidt trigger circuit, which converts it into very precise